Hi, welcome to Alaska Radio Reader Rambler, your monthly potpourri of literary snacks for the mind and interviews. I'm Sandy Harper, here with my co-host Dick Reichman and our very special guest, Timothy Daly, a wonderful playwright from Australia. Welcome, Timothy.
Thank you, Sandy. Thank you, Dick.
Yes. Welcome.
And, of course, you are no stranger to Alaska. Tell us about being in Alaska and, of course, your latest adventure in Alaska, the Last Frontier Theater Theatre Conference in Valdez.
Yes. This is my third. I'm starting to forget how many. Third or fourth trip to Alaska. Specifically, it was to go to the Valdez Last Frontier Theatre Conference, which more or less makes my third time. First time was just a couple of days. I was there for the full period last year, and I spent the full conference this time as well. And it was delightful. It was challenging. To me, the one thing I most demand from an artistic conference is generosity. That is, there's a lot to give and a lot to get. So everyone wins. And it's one of the most generous theatre conferences I've ever met. And I've been to lots of them,
really?
Internationally.
That's very
yes.
nice to hear.
Yeah.
Well, if you've been to a lot of them, tell me, I've only attended the one in Valdez over the years. Does it differ? Is the process in Valdez a very common one? Or how do they go in general?
Well, the Australian ones I've been to basically follow the elitist model that tends to operate in Britain. The elitist model says it operates from a mode of restriction, that is, times are hard, resources are scanty, let's deal with the top they're top six or seven people that we believe are the top six or seven people.
I mean, they already have established their careers.
That's right. And one or two will be admitted to this, inner sanctum. But I've always rebelled against this because at some point we're all outsiders. At some point we're all beginners. And who's to know who's going to flourish, et cetera. And I basically dislike the notion of a consensus of who's good, who's not, who's in, who's out, or who's hot, who's cold. It's sort of an insult to the idea of artistic freedom of possibility. And I well remember a director in Australia once met Willie Russell, and he asked, because she was looking for plays for her Australian theatre, and she went across. She spent about 4 hours with him. That is, he gave 4 hours of his time to her, and she was very honoured and chuffed. And she said, "Why have you done this? You didn't have to. You'd hardly know me at all. I'm so impressed and surprised." And Mrs. Russell, Willie Russell's wife, said, "Simple. Willie was encouraged when he started off, and he's doing the same now to younger writers because he was saying, try this writer, try that writer. He's interesting, she's interesting." In other words, who knows what would happen if Willie Russell had met the type of barriers that some conferences experience. So that's what I love about Valdez. I love the multiplicity of events. So there's almost a place for everyone there. The multiplicity of plays, the wide variety of styles, all that. And to me that says, come one, come all. And you're sure to find something alike, and you're going to find an acceptance as an artist. And if artists can't accept each other, who will?
Absolutely. And, not only serves the playwright in Valdez, but we also honor the actors and the directors and all their potentials, and just say collaborating together.
So. Yes, as a general rule in the arts, we prefer to work with people we like, not out of any subjective notion of friendship, preferment or something, but it's a very personal working process, and the value of a friendly conference is it expands your circle of likes.
Right. Well, did you like it expanded?
Oh, yes. I've lost count of the number of people who I've said we must stay in touch, and we will. I tend to carry out my threats, and so
watch out, you guys. Timothy will be in touch. But we have a long, ongoing relationship with Timmy beyond the conference, Dick and I, because Dick directed Timothy's wonderful play Kafka Dances some years ago, and I've always loved that.
Well, it was a clear turning point in my life. It was probably the thing that started me realizing I had a voice that could be heard internationally. It was a sort of devil-may-care. In that play, for example, I was convinced it would never be produced, never be performed. I wrote it to delight myself and, sort of fatalistically just put it onto the shelf. And then a director in Australia had faith in it. Then a director from Alaska had faith in it. A director from France sort of was stirred in it, Jerry discovered it in Alaska, Jerry Harper.
Yes.
He handed it over to Dick, and we formed a friendship and a working alliance. What I love is about artists is you mix the two. You're not sure whether it's friendship or a working, creative working alliance, that it turns work into a pleasure and, you know, gives a purpose to work.
Right, and you're carrying on that legacy by inviting Dick's new play to be performed in Australia.
Yes. Well, my personal motto is artists help each other.
Yes.
And it's not only out of gratitude. He's done a couple of my plays rather wonderfully, and it wasn't really a question of payback. It was more a question of you can't create opportunities that don't exist. He wrote a play. I think it's his finest play that I know, called The Big One, about the Valdez oil spill. And it had an epic dimension. It had a political urgency, topicality, even before Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, an opportunity came up in a thing I should have thought of actually a year ago, but it came up this year for in Australia, in Sydney. The oldest theatre, ironically, is called the New Theatre. It's been started off as a type of socialist workers' theatre, and it still goes to this day, almost a century old. And they have a very prestigious series called New Directions, which essentially is about voices from overseas, somewhere that shows us, well, what else could we be doing? Where else could we be heading? And I hadn't heard of this, despite being in the industry for years and years. And then I suddenly heard of it, and I thought, if the big one doesn't, you know, fit there, I'll eat Dick Reichman's hat. It has to. So I basically took business in theatre gets done over dinners and drinks and, you know, with people we don't mind spending an hour with. So I just basically did the lobbying. And it's, ironically, here's the fascinating thing. It's much easier to lobby for someone else's work than your own.
Mm.
And so you say, this is great, you should do.
That's right, the target's defences are down.
Well, they're not expecting it.
Exactly, yeah.
But then, of course, I understand, Dick, you're going to go see this production in Australia.
Yes, absolutely.
Which
absolutely
will be exciting.
Yeah, I've wanted to have a production that I didn't have my hands all over for a long time, and this is a wonderful opportunity. You gave a talk. I didn't go to the conference because I was involved here in Carolina Change, but you gave a talk about selling to American playwrights, selling your work overseas. And I think that the gist of the talk was that the work people are looking for overseas differs from the work that we in America are seeking. Talk about that difference.
Yes, it was a sort of a two-day workshop or two-part workshop over 2 days at Valdez because I've sort of stumbled onto this whole world. Essentially, initially it was the world outside Australia. To my amazement, it's also the world outside America. And the shocking news I often brought to people was the world is bigger than New York. And what that means is there's a whole variety of styles, genres, ways of writing theatre that are not present in much of American theatre. And so my stylistic curiosity made, because I had several plays in France produced and I saw what they were doing. You know, I'm working with a German director and translator, and he tells me what's happening in Germany. It made me realize that a lot of the dominant American models, unless you're very famous, they won't travel. And essentially because it's a lack of awareness on the part of American writers that they do theater differently. But to me, that's an exciting opportunity because the desire to do things differently should be part of any theatre writer's makeup. We're not born to write theatre one way. Most theatre writers, once they achieve competence, can turn their hands to a whole variety of styles. And it's not a lack of competence in the American theatre. Essentially, it's a lack of awareness of the big world outside. You know, Paris has 500 theatres you can go to any one night.
500?
And that's not counting the smaller ones, you know. That's a combination of the commercial and the public theatres.
Is it part of the French culture to go to live theatre?
That's right. Well, the French don't send their children to church. They send them to theatre. And, you know, so they grow up with a sort of respect for culture and in the expectation that if they're going to have a more formalised evening than just a night out at the bistro, they're going to spend it at a theatre or a show. And it's a very automatic reaction. And so that's just one. It's a major marker, but it's just one of them. And every time my work gets produced in another country, I study what's going on in that country. And to me, it's fascinating. It's just, you know, it's a big adventure. And my work at Valdez was showing the Americans how they can dominate the rest of the world, as they do in film. I'm being facetious, but, you know, artists are always showing opportunities because we're not really in competition.
No, well, you know, even in within the United States, you might have a very successful production, but having it produced in other theaters beyond the borders of your region is a big challenge as well as abroad.
Mm. You know. I call it the curse of regionalism. You know, a guy from Seattle or you name it, Minnesota, they'll be helped in Minnesota and they'll be, you know, they'll be supported, patronized in the good way, mm-hmm. but their work may never leave that place that supports them. And sometimes it's a question of just, sometimes it's quality, the work wasn't good enough to travel, but other times it's simply knowing what other cultures, other markets respond to. And I don't think that's cynical or opportunist, because theatre is a weird art. It's where you write work, not for yourself really, but for total strangers. And so knowing the psychological, cultural makeup of strangers is a big part of it.
But then they have to be able to read the play in order to take that next step to producing it. How does that work?
Well, it depends. I think the golden rule of international theatre is that theatre works on personal recommendation. Mm. Directors talk to each other about, what show are you doing? Directors often don't buy scripts, they buy shows.
Mm-hmm.
But they're artists who are constantly talking, travelling, meeting each other, offering opportunities to each other. If I was giving advice to an American writer, I'd say travel even before you have a play, which is where you meet people. You know,
networking. And
yes, but not in that cynical mm-hmm. way of, sort of crude back scratching. It's a sense of, modestly saying, I may have something for you. It's almost that simple. Show me what you do. Mm-hmm. If artistically I can rise to the challenge, I'd love to be involved. It's that. There's modesty in it as well as curiosity and ambition.
Yes. And is this also what you... I know you have an online playwriting mentorship, which is international.
Yes,
so
yes.
So is this sort of the things you are...
Yes, I've laboriously constructed my own website after years of resisting it. That's timothydailywriter.com. And it's which has all the things I do. But because essentially... in fact, the first hint that I had to do it came from you, Sandy Harper, which told me how hard I was to find. And I don't believe writers should be so hard to find, most give up, you know.
We did find you, though, and you actually had a guest residency when we did Kafka Dances.
Yes, oh, it was a glorious. As I said, it was one of the big life-turning moments when I realised, you know. I think it's wonderful when, you know, some theatres just do writers' work, but others do it and transform their career or even upgrade their artistry. You know, Cyrano's did a bit of all of it, really, and that to me is a great theatre relationship. So the least I could do was find a Sydney home for a work I deeply admired in Dick Reichman's The Big One.
Right, you're right. Well, you and Dick now have a deep friendship and an ongoing professional relationship as well, which is very wonderful.
It's terrific, yeah. And... as I say, artists help each other. They prefer, as the personal and the professional always get mixed up, and that's okay. I don't mind it.
Well, you know, actually, this was the last play that Jerry wanted to do before he died, so we delayed it a while because the daughter Jota had to be an actress who could also play the violin. And she was going to go away, and then she decided to stay, and that's why that was the real catalytic moment that I said, we're going to do it in honor of Jerry. And that's how that all started.
Yes, and I'm so glad you did. They were wonderful. It taught me a fascinating thing, which is don't rush urgently for the first production no matter what. Allow the life forces to move without getting too mystical. That is, don't push with a manic, frenzied intensity for the first, earliest, cheapest, most obvious production possibility. Things have their time.
Mm-hmm.
And if you just relax a little, you not only enjoy your life, but you enjoy the process of watching things grow and finding...
organic involvement.
Well, that's right.
But actually, Kafka Dances was extremely successful in Australia prior to our discovering it.
Oh, yes, that's true. It gave a blonde, unemployed actress her big start. Very few would know this, and it's actually factually true. Cate Blanchett, who starred in the Australian thing, she was unemployed for 7 months before that job.
Really?
In other words, she'd taken the typical actor's route. No one paid any attention, you know? It's not enough to be blonde. you know, even in Australia. you just line up, do the auditions, mm-hmm. and it was a sort of semi-miraculous merging of perfect part for her and her natural, you know, brilliance. And it was, and she starred in two seasons of the show, actually.
What I love is what I hear, that she's now an artistic director herself, as well as an actress in Australia.
Yes, yes. She's in a position where she can really, in a sense, give back and make a real contribution to Australian society. Now, to one extent, there's a turning point moment for her. Does she keep playing the Hollywood game,
mm-hmm.
or does she basically say, I'm here to do things other than just... I mean, she's already a celebrity, already famous. There's no need for her to...
But she's giving back and helping other artists.
That's my understanding and my belief, you know. And the very fact that she's taken a major theatre company is a good sign. She still does one... She does, I think, one film a year usually in Hollywood.
She could underwrite her theatre company that way, which is a good thing.
I think she's taken a pay cut in taking it.
Maybe you could tell us a little bit about your own writing, personal writing. I know that you're very disciplined. You write every single day, right?
Well, I do, except when I travel. I haven't yet solved the problem of how you travel and write regularly. Also, you know, if you're constantly meeting wonderful people, it's a beautiful distraction. But in retrospect, it re-energizes and gives you health. I've never felt so, you know, optimistic, buoyant, and enthusiastic. So, you know, what you think is an interruption turns out to be a type of blast of refreshment. And so you return to work redoubled. But I do believe in a little bit every day, if possible. I'm convinced 2 hours you can make a career. 2 hours of fresh hours a day, or one fresh weekend afternoon, you can create a writing career. Because good work takes time anyway. Mm-hmm. You may as well, you know, an actor friend in Australia says, you've got to let the grass grow back, rather than this idea of churning, always typing, etc., every day. So a little bit that's excellent is much better than a lot that's ordinary.
A page a day, a paragraph a day,
that's
whatever
right.
it
little
might
bits.
Be. I read where Hemingway stopped mid-sentence. He wrote regularly every day too, and so he would have somewhere to start the next day.
Yeah, it's not a bad... Oh, there are all these little tricks of Wagner used to fondle silk.
Ooh, which sounds very... It's a sensorial moment.
That's right. You know, I often light a stick of incense or something, simply to remind me it's something other than... you know, the ordinary. I often do need a sort of little fillip, a little kick up. But once the kick's there, away you go. I think Dick Reichman lives on coffee, for example.
Well, at least he's awake while he's writing, right?
It's interesting you're talking about the writing every day. Edward Albee, who used to come to the Valdez Theatre Conference, stuck in my mind very much when he described writing. He said, I do not write every day or any regular schedule. As a matter of fact, I try not to write for as long as I possibly can. I wait for the idea to be bursting out of me, and only then will I put anything on paper.
It's not a bad idea. It's the idea of... it's a psychological technique you apply to yourself. Put a type of pressure. Imagine the thing welling up in you.
Yes.
You know, Harold Pinter once rang up his director, Peter Hall, and said, I'm pregnant again, which says something is, you know...
Yeah, he felt it was incubating. When it was ready to be born, it was ready to be born. I don't think he did lots of rewrites once he wrote
Pinter,
it.
Huh?
No, Albee.
Albee, oh, really?
Yeah, but... of course, we do know he did one rewrite. When we did Zoo Story in Valdez, he came downstairs and told us, you know, I've been talking to the playwright, and I think he wants to change this line. And we did. And that was 40 years after he originally wrote the play.
Yes. No, I admire his writing a great deal. So, he's one of those people, a lot of writers say they went into theatre because of A, B, or C. One of them's often Albee. And... it's you know, he's very inspiring in lots of ways,
and he's also very generous. He really is.
Oh, look, he's travelled. He's not a young man, and yet only last year, or was it the year before? I've forgotten. It was 2006. Sorry, he travelled all the way to Australia for 2 or 3 weeks to work all day with lots of new writers, etc. You know, which he doesn't need that. You know, he doesn't need the money. He doesn't need to sit for 15 hours in a plane.
But he likes to inspire and pass it on.
I think he cares.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, of course, keep the standards high in theatre.
Well, yeah. occasionally I've heard him talk. Occasionally, you get the sense that he fears for the future, but I don't think you have to worry. You know, writers are constantly writing.
Right, but we have to kind of, I think, entice younger writers to the joys and the particular uniqueness of live theater. You know, a lot of young writers, they were writing movie scripts for a while, presenting them as theater, but they weren't really.
Yes, but the young writers are still coming up. So you hosted Will Eno, for example, you know, who's developing quite a reputation.
Mm-hmm.
He's now, correct me if I'm wrong, he's not very old, is he?
Who did you say?
Will Eno.
Will Eno.
Oh, Will Eno. Oh, no. But of course, Albie was his mentor. He was the one who encouraged him.
Yes.
We did produce one of his plays as well, and he was wonderful. He had an email communication with our director and actor for that. And wasn't that great?
Mm.
So.
Oh, yes. Email's our friend.
Mm. Well, Timothy Daly is our guest, Australian playwright. Who are the playwrights that you admire the most? As a writer, do you have a little stable of people that you most admire?
It's a huge gallery of, you know, it's a baseball team full of all-stars, if you ask me. Fader was probably the original. No, Ionesco was the first who made me realize this is theater is about a magic world. In other words, a lot of writers enter through essentially realist writers like David Mamet, Sam Shepard, Edward Albee.
Mm-hmm.
But I, for some reason, got first entranced by Eugène Ionesco, the French-Belgian writer.
Then was he produced in Australia then? Or you had read him? Or you've been to France?
I read him and then saw his work.
Mm-hmm.
The next big influence was Georges Feydeau, the farceur, because I just love the... Ionesco is a type of slowed-down Feydeau, as a lot of French writers' arts. What we don't understand about Feydeau, you know, we think, oh, these silly, frivolous farces. He's actually regarded as the second greatest dramatist in France.
You know, that was a play they performed in our country's good, you know, that play about the convicts going over to Australia. It was one of his.
Oh, no, that was Timberlake Wurtenberg.
She wrote the play.
Yes.
But the plot of the play was they performing a French play, which was supposed to humanize them. And
that's true, yes.
But anyway, go ahead with your other favorites.
Yeah, in other words, a lot of writers enter the realist via the door of realism, but I entered through the door of a type of magic theater. And I've always, there's a strain of American theater, Mack Wellman, Maria Irina Fornes, that basically they take a different view. And I've, you know, I'm very fond of that as well, because ultimately, I think theatre, without sounding too dogmatic, it's a slightly... Theatre's ultimate effect, I think, is or should be transformational. Now, what the surrealists or the less realist writers do is they start off being transformational. It's a technical challenge to keep it up, but the best of them succeed wonderfully. So, I mean, look, I learned something from everyone. I learned that you have to give characters a heart from Chekhov. I learned act structure from Ibsen. I learnt sort of focus in dialogue and what I call the horizontal level of energy, where character A is firing verbal or some sort of spatial energy across to another character. I learned that from Mamet and Shepard. You know, you name it, I learned something. I learned that you don't always have to be serious, for example, from Neil Simon. You know, he's often looked down on in a lot of theatre plays as, you know, the second or third most popular writer in the world. And I learned basically that sometimes theatre can be an act of generosity from the writer to audiences who aren't necessarily interested in all theatre's complex dynamics, but simply want the charm of story.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there are many theatres. So every time you read someone or get influenced by them, you realise there's no one theatre. I don't like the dogmatism of saying this is theatre. I like the flexibility of saying all these things are theatre.
Yes, I love being eclectic as well. But when do you reach that point? Of course, you're influenced and inspired by other great writers, but then finding your own unique individual voice.
Mm.
When do you remember doing that?
There was an early play, more or less the second play I wrote. I always knew I wanted to create something magical and mysterious, but the first successful play, full-length play, that really came across it was essentially Kafka Dances. Everything seemed to click.
Huh.
See, audiences can't take what I call the metaphysical continually. That is, Ionesco even sort of falters because you're not sure where to put yourself in it. And audiences actually go not to see stories. They, in a sense, they go to see themselves. And if they can't see themselves somewhere in the fictional theatre space, they psychologically withdraw to some extent, depending on which culture they're in. So the there are sort of like the realist, blending the realistic with the non-realistic or metaphysical is a big technical problem that can take years. And it took me a decade, really.
Really?
Yes, of trying.
Well, you know, of course, Kafka did love the Yiddish theater, so, and that was the surreal second level of your play. So did you do a lot of research about Yiddish theater?
Yes. I sometimes think I pick plays in order to read interesting books.
you like the research.
And the research is great fun, yes. Yeah. But ultimately, I've realized that a lot of our task today is to write plays that tell the audience things they don't read in the newspaper, assuming there even is a local newspaper. In other words, we're much more in the world of ideas than we thought we were.
Mm-hmm.
So if a play doesn't have what I call the informational level, that level on which goes deeper, it might be, for example, Dick Reichman's play about oil, you know, mm-hmm. I learned things I'd never heard before, never read before, never thought about before. And that's, you know, one of the big satisfactions of live theatre. So, I mean, if everything in Dick's play you could have just read in the New York Times Saturday edition, it would have failed on some significant level. But, you know...
Well, he had the advantage of actually being there, you know.
Yeah, well, the oil industry is so interesting. There's so much detail. You would think that taking stuff out of the ground and selling it would not be so incredibly complicated. But it has there's a whole world of knowledge, science, terminology, and behavior that goes with that process of bringing that fuel to market.
And the beauty of a complex world the audience didn't know is that it paralyzes their easy moral judgment. It's easy to walk into the big one, a play about the oil spill, thinking, oh, yes, those rascals, the oil company, etc. And I think sophisticated theatre tends to make nuances to one simple morality.
And whole complex human beings, like Dick didn't write villains and heroes especially.
No. You know. So, which means rich theatre is hard to turn into a tool of propaganda, and mm-hmm, I quite like mm-hmm. that too.
I agree. But, you know, what was fascinating about when we did produce it was only 20 years old, the episode of Valdez, and there are a lot of people who came to theatre. It was still raw in their hearts and minds, and that was very intense, both for the audience and for us.
It was marvelous to learn from the audience and post-play discussions. Usually post-play discussions aren't very interesting, but in this case, people who knew much more about the spill than I did and much more about the incidents that I chose to put in the play came to correct me or fix it or change that or you got it wrong or you got it right, you know, with more detail than I ever knew.
It was fascinating. It really was.
That's a wonderful situation to be in where the audience feels that it half owns the story already.
Yes, they're involved. I'm actually participants in the story in this case. You know, and then as you were pointing out, it's so sad about Louisiana echoing the situation that in the last 20 years, the oil company is still not prepared to handle emergencies.
Yes, I'm sorry to say that the Louisiana situation has made the big one yet again topical.
Sadly true, and the executives are spinning stories again. Anyway, Pat, thank you so much for being our guest today, Timothy, and we'll see you at your next play, your next time, and I'm looking forward to hearing about Dick's adventures in Australia with the big one.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Well, listen again next month for another episode of Alaska Radio Reader Rambler, and have a good month.